Okay, folks. So the next class would be an in-class exam at 10:26, and Lei and Will Cushing will be here to proctor the exam. Lei is actually already here, and I won't be here. So this is such that even if you're unhappy with the exam, I won't be here until next week. So so that's basically it, and I believe there was, yesterday there was an office hour, some more people showed up, and also this morning Will had some sort of a registration session, a lot more people showed up, and presumably you're all prepared and all that stuff. Are there any additional things that you need to worry about? Any questions regarding the exam? I never do reviews in the class time normally. Because if you have a specific question, you should just come and talk to us. Or we would be happy to do extra outside of the class. I did that yesterday, and Will was doing it today. I just don't feel like boring people who already understood everything. Makes no sense. And if you haven't understood, which is completely possible, just find any of us. I would still be here tomorrow early morning. I'll still be here until about 9:30, 10, and then of course I'll be here today. That I have class or office hours, and I can talk longer if needed. So that's the story. Yes, sir. It'll be open book. I mean, I always do open book because, and although I think if you normally my exams are long, and if you are opening the book to figure out where the various formulas are, oftentimes you would be at a disadvantage. But it's open book. I'm not going to check in. Yes, sir.
Is it open book or open book, open notes?
Open book, open notes. But not open internet. Okay? Not open internet. That's basically it. Yes. Yeah, so I probably will do that too. I have my midterm is, anytime I do an in-class exam, I also allow people to take it home. So not take that exam home. So you will have the option of doing another fresh copy of the same exam at home. Okay? And if you read that, all those rules are explained, it would be repeated this time too. The idea is you don't just get to do the couple of questions that you thought you did wrongly. If you decide to do it at home again, you have to do the entire exam, okay? And it would be due whenever I said it's due. You know, I haven't yet told you, for this exam. So, and it will be due in the class. And normally what I would do is I would grade the in-class version, and probably the TA would go grade the at-home version, and there's some complicated arithmetic that goes on to compute the at-home version, the weighted average of the in-class and at-home to compute your grade, and then take any extra you have to make that to be extra credit. Okay? You never ask me what I do with all this extra credit, and I'm not going to answer if you don't ask me, but there are ways in which this gets to you. What? Is it worthwhile to do it? Yeah, if you haven't done it right, you need to do it well, so that you'll feel good, ultimately. I don't know whether it's worthwhile to do it. It depends on your demand, your metrics, okay? So it's particularly meant for people who just have major problems dealing with time pressure, okay? I had this exchange student from Germany who is among the smartest students I ever came across. And that guy, obviously is very fluent in German, but obviously not fluent in English, and definitely can't figure out the speed at which I speak English, and then the long sentences I write. So he had trouble, in making up, just understanding the exam. So for him, 1 hour, 15 minutes was enough just to understand the exam. But he was smart. And so when he took it home, he would get 100 out of 100. Okay. I mean, that's, it's not that I can make up for all the, see, I mean, since the world has been made in such a way that exams are required for all of you guys, presumably the people who truly are brilliant people who are just bad at taking exams have been weeded out. They are making Microsofts of the world and they're not taking courses here, okay? So I think you guys are good at taking exams, so you'll do it. But nevertheless, if you feel that you know more than what you're able to show in under the exam stress, you can do it again. Okay, it's completely up to you. I cannot answer whether it's worth it or not. Okay, I mean, I just, all I'm doing is we're going to increase our work. So what more can I do? I mean, I'm actually going to increase his work, but that's a different story. Any other question? So again, remember that it's not that you can take the home, in-class exam home and complete it at home. That's not the way it is. And you would be taking, I mean, these guys have, they're going to just take the exam away at the end of the class. And whatever is in that exam is what I see. Okay, normally the at-home version is graded by the TA. Okay, and you could not, and here's one thing though. If you decide not to do that, since it is meant to be an extra credit, nobody who decides not to do it can ever be penalized. That's the way extra credit works. So in my course, when I convert numbers into grades, I don't look at the extra credit column. Okay, now of course you can never be sure that I don't peek, but you have to believe me. Okay, I won't peek, I will set the grade thresholds without looking at the extra credit marks. And if a threshold has been established and you are below that threshold based on the normal cumulative, but then with the bank marks in the bank, you cross it, you get the higher grade. That's the way it's done. Okay, I mean, that's the best I can do. If I make extra credit to be part of the grade determination, then it's not extra credit really. Then there would be bloodbath here. People will be killing each other to stop them from doing the extra credit. You know, so I don't want that. Okay, it truly is extra credit, you know, and that's the way it is. And in fact, I showed that even in the most recent rock numbers I sent you, I differentiated extra credit marks from the total. So that's the way it is. You know. And it, you guys were ranked in terms of the totals, not the extra credit. So if you add up, the ordering might be different. Other questions? Okay. So what I am planning to do today is inference over with Bayes networks, and once I complete inference with Bayes networks, if I get done with the techniques that I'm going to discuss, then I will start talking about first order logic. So we talked about propositional logic, we talked about probabilistic propositional logic, we are about to complete inference with that, and the next topic is first order logic. Okay? So let's start with inference and how hard is the inference in probabilistic reasoning, in Bayes networks in particular. The good news is that it's not, I mean, so the news is that essentially it is as hard as the propositional reasoning, which should not be surprising because in fact you can do propositional logic using Bayes networks. Okay, basically the conditional probability tables will then only have zeros and ones as the number. That's essentially deterministic dependencies. So for example, if I have P, Q, and then here is a thing called PRQ is this node, right, which is A equal to PRQ, then the conditional probability table will basically be in terms of when P is true, Q is true, 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 1.0, true, false, 1.0, etc. Okay? So all the entries will be ones and zeros. False, false would be 0.0. That's the only thing. Okay? So you could actually write a bunch of propositional logic formulae as a Bayes network. Okay, so clearly Bayes networks cannot be cheaper than propositional logic. One good thing is it looks almost as if, in fact, inference on Bayes networks is NP-hard, which is the same thing I said about inference on propositional reasoning. Except it's slightly harder in the sense that inference on Bayes networks involves counting models. If you remember from what we talked about, probabilistic reasoning involves counting, not just finding the number of satisfying, not just finding a satisfying model, but counting the number of models that satisfy the world. So it's actually, there is a class called SharpV, which is the counting equivalent of the decision problems. Okay, so it's considered SharpV complete, and it's expected to be harder in a sense. Now, this is just a picture showing that if you have a base net, you can reduce a 3-sat problem to a base net inference problem. Now, what's a 3-sat problem? It has a bunch of theory clauses, okay, such that what we are trying to find is if there is an assignment of truth falsity values for the proposition such that the entire set of clauses is satisfied. Okay, so suppose I have these three clauses, AR, BR, C, CR, DR, not A, BR, CR, not D, I can write the following base network. This is A, B, C, D, and then this corresponds to the first clause, this corresponds to the second clause, this corresponds to the third clause, and this corresponds to the AND of those three. Now, you can write down the conditional probability tables for these, right? Because they will have just ones and zeros. They would be CPTs. They'll have ones and zeros. Okay? And similarly, you can write down the conditional probability tables for these two. Okay? Now, the question, what would you need to check to see whether there is a satisfiable model or not? Basically, is there some assignment of values to A, B, C, D such that this AND node can take value 1 rather than value 0? Okay? And the way you could do that essentially is you could compute prior, you could compute the probability of AND itself. Okay? As long as the probability of AND is not 0, that means there is a satisfying assignment. Okay, so in some sense, I basically converted 3-sat into a Bayes network inference algorithm, inference question. And since 3-sat is known to be NP-hard, this problem is also NP-hard. Okay, so that's the where you start. Now, we do know, for example, that in propositional logic, there are cases which were not NP-hard, right? If, for example, if you only had modus ponens, so if you only had Hahn clauses, if you only had Hahn clauses in the database, then it turns out that reasoning over them was polynomial time. Okay, so there are special cases for Bayes networks too, like that. In particular, the most useful one, the most general useful result that we know is if the Bayes network is singly connected, if its topology is such that it's singly connected. Now, where the definition of singly connected means there is at most one directed path, one path between any pair of nodes. At most one path between any pair of nodes. Okay? If it's singly connected, then you can be sure that inference is polynomial. If it's not singly connected, then all bets are off. Okay, that's a general rule. So for example, if I have a Bayes network of the following form, what do you think? Is that singly connected? Yes. In fact, it's a chain. And if in fact these are, you know, these are normally called Markov chains, especially if this variable, if you think of this as AI plus 1, AI plus 2, AI plus 3, so on. So the value of A in the I plus 1 instant depends only on the value of A in the ith instant. Okay, this is your Markov chain. Markov chains are Bayes networks, by the way. Everything is a Bayes network. In fact, many, many things you have seen. If you thought about hidden Markov models, we will talk about Markov chains and hidden Markov models when we talk about time, handling time, especially in the context of either logic or probabilistic reasoning. But Markov chains and hidden Markov models look like this. That's your hidden Markov model, where there are a bunch of variables. These are the important variables that are changing, that are causing each other, but you can't observe them. What you can observe is the observable variables, O1, et cetera, okay. Now, that's the hidden Markov model. That's how the Bayes net looks like for a hidden Markov model. Is that singly connected? Yeah? It's singly connected. So again, hidden Markov model, Bayes network, the Bayesian inference on the hidden Markov model, if you take the entire network, is polynomial in the size of the network. Okay? Anything which is not singly connected, so is this a singly connected network? It better not be, right? If it is, then I just told you that singly connected network inference is polynomial, and I just told you that here is a scenario where it converts 3SAT into, Bayes network, and 3SAT is an NP-hard problem. Okay, it's not singly connected because if you consider A and AND, A can get to AND this way, A can get to AND this way, and then similarly B can get to AND this way, B can get to AND this way, multiple paths. Okay. Now, so this is the best you can think of. Singly connected networks, whenever you have singly connected network, inference is polynomial. It's sort of like whenever you have Hahn clauses, inference, logical inference is polynomial. That's one class. Now, so let's just talk about, suppose we don't care about complexity per se, we just want actual algorithms to do the inference on the Bayes network. Okay, so here are here's the way the picture is. First of all, there are like a ton of approaches for doing Bayes network inference. It's a huge, huge cottage industry. We will only just talk about one approach in the exact side and a couple of approaches on the approximate side. Okay. So exact inference essentially means you want to compute the exact value. You don't want to estimate the value. You want to compute the exact value. Okay. Now, first of all, in case this is becoming abstract, let's just remember what sort of questions might we ask of a Bayes network. What am I saying when I say inference? Okay, the kinds of inference questions we can ask are: you can ask, given some evidence, tell me the distribution of some variables, posterior distribution of some variables, given some evidence. Okay. And then I can also ask conjunctive queries, what's the posterior distribution of Xi and Sj given evidence. I can also, so these at least, these two you should understand. There are many other things that you can ask a Bayes network to do, but ultimately it's all a question of, that generally you'll ask, here are a bunch of nodes whose values I know, I have observed. Given this, tell me what do you think is the distribution, posterior distribution, on some other node. Okay? In particular, actually, you call these the query nodes. Xi are the query nodes because you want to know the posterior distribution over Xi. Okay? And you call these the evidence nodes. Now, in an entire network, these may not just be all the nodes. I mean, E are the evidence nodes. X are the ones that you are interested in finding the posterior distribution of. X plus E does not necessarily equal the entire network. Okay? So there are a bunch of nodes that are left in the network, which are neither X nor E. And those are, in essence, the hidden variables in this query. With respect to this query, they are not the evidence variables. They are not the query variables. But they kind of connect, evidence to the query. And in fact, in a minute, we'll see that much of what is involved in computing these numbers exactly is marginalizing over those hidden variables. So summing over those hidden variables. Okay, we'll see that in a minute. But these are the kinds of questions that we are trying to ask your network. And when I say NP-hard, I mean, you know, computing these numbers is NP-hard. Okay, so getting those numbers exactly, and the other important thing you want to understand is prior versus posterior distribution. Okay, normally Bayes networks are used to compute the posterior distribution. But you can also ask just to compute the prior distribution, which is without knowing any evidence, what is the probability that the Xi is true versus false? And in fact, if it's a multi-valued variable, what's the probability that Xi will have value V1, value V2, value V3, etc. And in fact, the previous, the complexity thing that we were looking at, we were just looking at the prior. Because if the prior probability of AND being true is not zero, then it's satisfiable. Okay. So these are the questions you're going to ask. And so how exact inference essentially tries to compute those numbers exactly. And as I said, these are NP-hard. And, oh, okay, these are NP-hard. Okay. And it's polynomial for singly connected networks. And there are a whole ton of algorithms to compute exact inference, to do exact inference, okay? One of which we'll look at, in fact, two of which we'll look at. One is enumeration, one is variable elimination, okay? In fact, there is a zeroth order one that you already know, which is use joint, okay? Remember that given the Bayes network, you can compute the joint distribution. I told you that. And given the joint distribution, you can compute any query. I told you that. So you can always go from the Bayes network to the joint, and then you know everything that you ever want. Okay? Much of what you are, and in the worst case, you really cannot avoid computing the joint, whether explicitly or implicitly. In the worst case, you cannot avoid it. But in some special cases, you would like to avoid computing the joint. So for example, you know, take a very simple network here, let's say. Right? Simple network here. And suppose all I'm asking is, what's the probability that C is true given B is true? That's the only question I asked. And if you just ran and computed the joint probability distribution to answer that question, you just made your life much harder than it needs to be. Because after all, you know this number. This is actually given directly. You understand what I'm saying? So this is the extreme case where this number is given in the CPT. Okay? In general, you could compute certain types of numbers much faster, certain types of numbers will take longer. In the worst case, you would wind up doing the entire joint distribution. In computing the exact, in doing the exact inference, the best you can do is try not to enumerate more of the joint distribution than is needed to answer the question. Point one. And point two, try not to enumerate it explicitly at all. Okay, so don't build an entire big table first. Because as nice as it sounds conceptually, if you have, let's say, 10,000 variables, Boolean, 10,000 variables, or maybe Boolean 1,000 variables, then the joint distribution is a 2 power 1,000 sized table. First, writing that table down and then using it seems crazy. So you want to avoid, in fact, there's a space issue. Where are you going to get 2 power 1,000 space? Okay, so you want to at least avoid converting it into space, that, you know, explicitly writing out the joint. Now, we will talk about, the good algorithm we'll talk about is the variable elimination. The easy algorithm you already know, using the joint. If it's a small network, you should be able to write the joint out and answer all the queries. And the enumeration algorithm essentially tries to do using of the joint, but does it implicitly. Okay? There are also many other algorithms that we won't talk about, some of which essentially are good at the following kinds of things. These algorithms essentially try to answer a single query. Given the evidence E, what is the posterior on such a small subset of variables X? Sometimes you might want to ask, given the evidence E, what is the posterior on all the other variables? All other variables, not just one, the rest of the network. Okay? It turns out that you can answer that question by using these algorithms multiple times, one for each of those variables. But that winds up essentially involving more and more repeated work. So in such cases, there are better algorithms, which are these basically message passing algorithms, which repeatedly pass messages along the Bayes network until each node ultimately has its posterior distribution computed automatically. Okay? So this is sort of like finding the shortest path to a single node versus finding the shortest path to all nodes. Okay, that's sort of a difference. So, you know, there are such algorithms and, you know, we won't talk about them. One useful class of algorithms that we did not ever worry about previously, which you can do here in probabilistic reasoning, is approximate inference. And in fact, we'll spend a lot of time talking about those two. There, in essence, you're computing the probabilities by Monte Carlo methods. Computing the probabilities by, you know, Monte Carlo methods. So, for example, how many of you know that you could compute, let's say, if you don't know the value of pi, you can compute the value of pi by essentially taking a little table, you know, a sheet, which is square, put a circle, inscribe the circle in it, and then drop pins into this. Okay? And based on where the pins are falling, you know, if you're randomly dropping pins, pins are falling all over the place. Okay. Now, the number of pins which fall inside the circle divided by the total number, that's connected to pi. And in fact, it's a very cheap way to compute pi. Okay. And, you know, these are called Monte Carlo methods. It's like you do sampling and using the samples, you're estimating something. Okay. We will look at Monte Carlo methods for Bayes network inference. So, you're using samples from the network to compute various probabilities. It turns out, in fact, that sampling methods are some of the best methods for large-sized Bayes networks right now. Okay, so we need to understand them. Now, normally the problem with sampling methods is how fast do you converge to the correct estimate? Point one and point two, would you actually converge to the correct estimate at all? Okay, and those are the issues that you have to worry about. And it turns out the approaches that we talk about, you know, they differ from each other in terms of they all converge to the correct probabilities, asymptotically, if you do infinite number of experiments. But the rate at which they converge changes. You know, for the simpler methods, they converge slower, and the more interesting methods converge faster. Okay, and to solve this, it's like very interesting. These algorithms, all you need is a coin, a biased coin. That's all you need. Okay, and a biased coin which will come, especially if you only have Boolean variables, all you need is a biased coin which will come, let's say, p probability heads and 1 minus p probability tails. And you can simulate such coins in software, in essence. Okay, using your random number generator in any of your computer, in any of your languages, you can simulate biased coins. And so all you need is just repeatedly using those. We'll look at that. Okay. Notice that, of course, one interesting thing is if you're doing approximation, would you be able to get approximation to a constant factor much faster than? So the cost, all complexities are worst case complexities. So NP hard means in the worst case you take exponential amount of time. Exact inference is NP hard in the worst case. Is approximate inference with some guarantees, is that any easier? So for example, if I tell you, I'm happy if you give me probability within, the correct probability within a factor, let's say factor of, 1.02 away from the real probability. Okay, it turns out, unfortunately, that Bayes networks even the approximation is hard. So you can't give a guarantee. So you cannot solve, you cannot give a polynomial time algorithm that can solve the, that can give you the probabilities within a factor, for any factor. Okay? So in a way, it is, it's sort of a hard problem. There are problems, for example, where approximate algorithms are easier. A classic problem that you have heard about is in this class, and you know, I'm sure you've been thinking about it, is Bloxworld, right? So if you just think of Bloxworld as a problem unto itself, and you have a bunch of blocks and you want to put them in a different configuration, it turns out that finding the optimal length Bloxworld plan is NP-hard. But there is a way of solving Bloxworld problems very easily, which is, first thing, you just shake the table such that everything comes onto the table. There are no stacks. So put everything on the table first and then build the stacks that you want. Okay? And this can be shown to be at most two times the length of the optimal plan. At most two times the length of the optimal plan. So if you don't mind getting a plan which is within a factor of two from the optimal plan, it's polynomial time. But if you want the optimal plan, it's NP-hard. All I'm saying is, for Bayes networks, that sort of thing doesn't exist. Even if I want like a factor approximation, it's still NP-hard. Okay. And then we'll look at a bunch of stochastic simulation algorithms, in particular sampling from empty networks, rejection sampling, likelihood weighting, and maybe, time permitting, Markov chain Monte Carlo. Okay. So let's start talking about inference by enumeration, which is the, not the dumbest, but close to the dumbest idea. Not dumbest idea is basically that, that you should know. It's not necessarily the dumbest idea. An idea that you should know is, given the Bayes networks, writing all joint probability distribution numbers, and then from there going to anything you want. Okay. Now, just remind ourselves, if I have wanted, let's say, if I wanted probability of A and, A and not J and not M and E and not B, that's an entry in the joint probability distribution, right? How would I get that? So I will start with P of not B. I know that number, times P of E times P of A given not B and E times P of not J given A times P of M given A, P of not M given A. And all these numbers are given to you in the conditional probability table. So you just multiply them and you will know this number. And this way you can compute all 32 numbers. There, because there are 5 variables, you can compute all the 32 numbers this way. And once you have those 32 numbers, you can answer any query in the world. This is the zeroth level idea. You should understand that. If you don't, you're in big trouble. Okay? The first level idea, this one essentially, it first writes the entire joint distribution. And then you start using it. All we are doing in this case, essentially, is avoiding explicitly enumerating the joint. Okay. So there is an interesting point. So first of all, we'll focus mostly on these kinds of queries, because that's the kind of queries that you often ask. Okay. So given some evidence variables and their current state, tell me the posterior on some query variable. So in this case, the J and M are the evidence variables. So normally the way you would do that is sort of shade those. These are the evidence variables. And B is the query variable. Okay, in this network. And then A and E are the intermediate variables. They are not part of the evidence, they're not part of the query, but they wind up affecting. They connect the evidence to the query variable. Some of them are relevant, some are irrelevant. We'll see that in a minute. Okay. But now if I want to do this, PB given J and M, what I can actually do is, first thing I'll notice is that this is just the definition of conditional probability, that's PBJM by PJM. Comma is AND. Okay. So now, this basically, capital letters, by the way, are variables, so you're thinking of distribution for b equal to true as well as false. Small letters means the value itself. Small b means burglary happened. Small j means John is calling. John has called. Okay? That's the idea. So now I could write this as PBJM by PJM. Okay? Now, this, if I'm anyway computing the entire distribution over b for all values of b equal to true and false, then I really don't need to compute the bottom, PJM, because if I compute these values for both b equal to true and b equal to false, then they should normalize. They must add up to 1. Do you understand what I'm saying? So suppose I computed this to be alpha times 0.3 to be the b equal to true, and alpha times 0.4 for b equal to false, then I can essentially normalize these such that they sum to 1. So what you would do is essentially you'll say 0.3 by 0.3 plus 0.4 is the first number, and then 0.4 by 0.3 plus 0.4 will be the second number. This is the normalization. So we would assume that you can always do this normalization. Given a vector, you can always normalize it such that it adds up to 1. Because it's obvious, okay? So that's why we'll assume that you can compute this by essentially just computing this number, probability of BJM, where B equal to true, J true, M true, and B equal to false, J true, M true. Those are the two numbers you need. If you get both those numbers, then you are in business. You essentially know the distribution, okay? Now, up to here, we haven't even looked at the Bayes network. Up to here, we didn't even look at the Bayes network. This is just normal probability theory. Now we look at the Bayes network, and you'll notice that really BJM can be written essentially, first of all, even this step is actually without Bayes network. It turns out that in the set of variables you have is not just BJ and M, it's BJ, M, A, and E. So if you want a conjunctive probability on just three variables, how do you get it? You sum over the other two variables. Do you understand? So if I give you the joint probability distribution of A and B, so A and B, a number, not A and B, another number, not A, not B, another number, and then whatever, not A and B, the fourth number. If I give you those four numbers and I ask you what is P of A, then you just add up the two numbers where A is true and B can be false or true. So that's called summing over the missing variable. Okay? So in this case, what are you doing? You're just summing over the two hidden variables, E and A. And then you just sum over the values of E and A. Right? Now, what do you do here at this point? Up to this, it's all very simple. And one other, so now, PBEAJM, this thing can be written as that. This is the first time you use the Bayes network. Until now, you haven't used the Bayes network. Okay? To go from this to this, you use the Bayes network. The Bayes network essentially told you, if you want this, then it's nothing but probability of B times probability of E times probability of A given B and E times probability of J times A, J given A and M given A. Now, you notice that there is still two summations over E and A in front of this. So you have to compute this number for E equal to true as well as E equal to false and A equal to true as well as A equal to false. And each time there is a different multiplication. All of these with b equal to true first time, and the whole thing with b equal to false the second time. Then you would get the two numbers. Then you normalize them, you get the posterior. Okay? So, that's basically, now the only other thing that you can do now is, this is summing over E, this is summing over A. Okay? Now, there is no E on this particular, to consider A, let's say, this summation doesn't really apply to this particular expression because that's just probability of B. It doesn't depend upon A. Okay? It doesn't even apply to this. it applies first time here. So what I'll do is I'll take the summation and shift it here, which is very useful. It looks like just a small shift, but what I'm doing is, since A only affects this part of the product, you may as well push it to the part that it actually affects. So now I can compute these for different values of A, and then you don't have to recompute them when these parts change. That doesn't still change because A, they only depend on A. And similarly, E can be shifted here. Now the shift of the summations into the product is very useful, because in essence what we are saying is you are doing the summation only over the parts that are affected by that variable. Okay? Now, so this in essence, you can compute this thing automatically by going recursive depth first, and you can take linear space, and of course it will take exponential time because it is in ultimately computing every entry of the joint distribution. If you look at how that particular thing, if you look at how this particular product is evaluated, it looks like this. Okay, so in essence what we are saying is you would be summing over different values of A here over these two parts. Okay, and then summing over different values of E here, then multiplying it by PB. Okay, so this picture in essence corresponds to this. Okay, so this in essence what you're doing in the second idea, the zeroth idea we already know. In the first order idea, we are computing this tree in the depth first fashion. We are traversing this tree in the depth first fashion. Okay. One good thing is at least you don't need like a huge big table where you store the joint entry. Okay. However, you can notice that it winds up doing same numbers multiple times. So for example, if you look at this, if you look at this, Pj given A, Pm given A, 0.9 times 0.7. You computed it here by multiplying. You did the same thing here by multiplying. Now you'll say, yeah, no, what the heck, I mean, it's just a multiplication. You know, how does it matter? But if you repeat multiplication many, many times than is needed, then you're wasting time. You can trade. So what happened here is, space-wise, this is extremely efficient. But time-wise, it's doing repeated multiplication in various parts of the tree because of the way the joint decomposes into pieces. You wind up doing the same multiplication here as well as here. If you are smart, you could, as soon as you do this multiplication, you open a table and say, by the way, PJA given PMA is this number. So that if you ever ask me, I'll just look up that table. Think of this as materialization if you are a database person. Or think of this as memoization if you are an algorithms person. So you memo yourself. I've done this number work, you know, been there, done that, here is the answer. So that next time I have to solve it, don't start all over again, look at the table. Okay? Now what am I giving up to get what? I'm giving up space. I have to store these factors. Okay? And it could be that my hope is that the individual factors will wind up having fewer number of variables than does the entire joint. If so, I'll win big. If not, in essence, I will wind up, you know, keeping exponential space. Okay? This idea is essentially called variable elimination idea, and all it's doing is, it's doing the exact same thing as before. This picture, this particular expression is what we just saw earlier. This was the expression we saw in the last page, okay? Because remember, we pushed the summation over A up to here and summation over E up to here. Except we, other than that, we weren't doing anything. So other than that, we were just essentially looking at this entire tree, you know, for every value, okay? Now what we would do is you will say, look, really speaking, this whole thing here is a table whose value, in essence, depends only on B and E, because A is summed out. So I can store that, so that for every different value of B and E that I would be needing when I come up to this point, I will look up that table. Okay? So this is remembering intermediate reserve, so that you don't have to repeat. You know, people from database side of the spectrum would understand this, because you always want to remember intermediate reserve so that you won't do too much work. Okay? These factors are materialization of the intermediate reserve. So all we are doing here is, in fact, start by saying that this in itself is a factor that's just dependent on M. A factor essentially, this is a factor just dependent on M. So this is a FM factor which gives different values based on the A. Okay? And this is an FJ factor which gives different values based on A. And then this is an FA factor, which gives different values based on A, B, and E. And then by the time you come here, this operation, in essence, sums over the different values of A, such that A just disappears. By the time you come out of this part, A has disappeared. So some variables can go out. So the sizes of the tables can become smaller. Okay. So in this particular case, what you wind up doing is, to go from here to here, all you did was this. You essentially multiplied F, this factor's value for ABE times this factor's value for A times this factor's value for A. That's the first one. And the other one is for not A. This factor's value for not A, this factor's value for not A, this factor's value for not A. Okay? Now, in fact, this operation, so if you think of each of these factors as tables, the product between these tables is not Cartesian product. It's not matrix multiplication. It is something that should be very familiar to database people. It's more like a join. Okay? What you're saying is, you take an entry from this table, and since this is the table on A, then you take the entry from this table which has the same value of A as here. That's join over A. And then this also has the same value of A. So join over A here, join over not A here. Okay, so that's the factor multiplication. And, you know, when you do this, you, in essence, at this point, before you go up, you actually make this table. So in a pictorial form, what you're doing is, you're computing this entire table first and storing it. And then when you come using E and you ask for different entries of the factor for different values of B and E. B is already the element whose value, whose posterior you're trying to compute, and E you know from the previous. So E would be, E is being set here. Okay? So in this particular case, you are taking this entire thing, putting in a table, and then by the time you come, you look at that factor and not avoid the computation. Okay? So this is the idea of variable elimination. And this can, in cases where the factor, so now how big do you do need intermediate space to store the factors? The size of the intermediate space you need depends on the size of the biggest factor. If you have an N variable network, and if the biggest factor depends on M, such that M is much less than N, then you get by, you get huge improvements, but just only with 2 power m sized table rather than 2 power n sized table, which the first one would have done. Okay. So the two operations that you do in the variable elimination are, one is when you have a summation over a product of factors, you push the summation inside such that it only affects the factors which depend on that particular variable. That's what we did when we pushed the E and A inside the summation. And the second one is when you're multiplying two factors, where this one is, this factor is X1 up to YK, and this one is Y1 up to ZZ, you multiply by joining over the Y1 to YK values. So the entry from here and the entry from here must have the same Y1 to YK values. And you multiply those two numbers. One thing that is sort of what noticing is that, for example, if you had asked the following question, John, distribution of John given burglary, distribution of John given burglary, okay? If you do the exact same thing as before, you would wind up noticing that M would get shifted all the way here, and the summation over P of M given A for different values of M. So P of M given A for M equal to true and M equal to false. What does that correspond to? That's one. Given the value of A, probability that M is true given that A, and probability that M is false given that same evidence, you have to sum to one. Okay? So if you were just doing that exact work, in this scenario, what you would wind up doing is you will have a factor which essentially is 1. Okay, the reality is this essentially tells you that M has no bearing on the query that you're asking. So in fact, to answer this query exactly, you could have removed M from the network, completely removed M from the network, and you could still have gotten the exact same answer. And if you can do that, wouldn't you want to do it? If you have a smaller network you can answer, that you can infer on, which will give you the same answer as the bigger network, then you would like to do that. So in this case, essentially, M is an irrelevant variable given the query. It's not always irrelevant. It's because of this particular query, J, you know, given B, to answer this, you don't need M. So you can remove it. So in general, variable elimination can be improved by reasoning over irrelevant variables. Okay? And irrelevant variables, the simplest idea is this. What you can do is you can remove any leaf node that's neither a query variable, any leaf node that's neither a query variable nor an evidence variable. You can remove it. Once you remove it from the net graph, then there'll be new leaf nodes. The guys who were interior previously, but they become leaf now. Okay, now you can ask, are you a leaf node such that you are not a query variable or an evidence variable? You get to remove that too. And you can prove that if you remove all these guys, you'll have a smaller network, and just reasoning over that smaller network would give you the same exact values as if you reasoned over the entire network. Okay, now this should not be too surprising for you, because suppose you have a huge large Markov net, Markov chain, okay, 1,000 variables. And all I am asking is, given that B equal to true, what is the posterior distribution of C? You know that particular question better be answered very easily. It has no connection to anything else other than B and A. And in this particular, so this idea should help you realize that. You would keep cutting everything off until your network is just B dash, B going to C, and then you answer it on the stack. Okay? So, yes, sir.
Does this have anything to do with the concept of independence of siblings given?
It's connected. In fact, in the next slide, we'll talk about moralizing a directed graph and separating it. So, anyway, so this is the general idea, and it turns out you can actually say that this is basically a recursive idea. You keep removing until you can't remove any further. And what this is doing is the same as what this theorem is saying. So a variable y is irrelevant unless y belongs to the set of ancestors of X union E. So Y better be an ancestor of either X variable or the E variable. Otherwise, it has no business being in the query. Okay? Now, it turns out, so that basically clearly says in this case that if John is calling, so if you're asking for probability of John calling, given burglary happened, then the only variables which are ancestors of J and B are A, E. So M is out. That's why you removed M. Okay. And then once you figure out the irrelevant variables, you can remove them from the network. So you can act as if they don't exist at all, and you have a much smaller problem to solve. Okay. This is important because if you don't do that, in essence, even this simple probability would be computed by the variable elimination algorithm in the hard way. It will materialize all the factors, many of which will be 1.0s. And yet it will go through the notion. But you want to just cut it up front. A slightly more stronger, so this rule is correct in the sense if Y is irrelevant by this rule, it is irrelevant. But there may be more variables which are irrelevant than this, and you may miss that. So if you remove variables based on this rule, you can't go wrong, but there may be other things you could have removed too. And a stronger one, which is actually not described in the text, but it's here, is essentially based on the separability of the graph. Okay? So you take the Bayes network, and you consider a moralized version of this network. It's a nice word, you know, it's like a Jerry Falwell kind of a word. So if A has parents B and E, what the heck are those parents doing without being married? Okay, so first thing you do is you marry them. So you put an edge from B to E. Okay, for every node, put an edge between its parents. Once you do that, you remove the directionality. Now this is a moral graph. So all family values, everybody is born in a married parent family. Maybe multiple parents, unfortunately, but you know, there is that. And so you have a nice undirected graph here, B, E connected A, J, and M. Okay? And then this theorem essentially says that Y is irrelevant, and then you know, in this graph, you can talk about separability. So you would say, for example, that what? You could say that J is separated from E by A. Because if you remove A from the graph, J cannot go to E. Every path from J to E must go through A. This is a normal notion of separability in graphs. Okay? And I would say, and you'd basically say that a variable Y is irrelevant if it is M separated from the query variable by the evidence variable. So for example, if my query variable is John, okay, and alarm is my evidence variable, okay, then burglary and earthquake are also gone now. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now this is exactly the kind of thing I'm asking for. If somebody asks you what is the probability that John calls given alarm equal to true, it better be a single lookup into the network. And variable elimination algorithm should not just go through all the motions computing all sorts of numbers. So if I ask this question, John calls given alarm equal to true, okay, in my normal Bayes network, which is this. If I ask you, John calls given alarm equal to true, that's like asking the question, C is true given B is true. Because that number is present right here at the conditional probability table of J. And it should variable elimination algorithm should automatically realize that. Okay? So how would it happen here? It would have actually realized that M, B, and E are irrelevant to the query. So it removes M, B, and E. And then you only have the network A and J, and it sums over A and J, and that's exactly what you expected to have. It's a nice point. Okay? If you don't remove the irrelevant variables, then even the simple queries could take longer than necessary. Okay. Question? Yes. In this case, all you did is to moralize the graph. You took parents of every node, married them up. Yes, I said that. Remember, this theorem is weak. If this theorem says something is irrelevant, it is irrelevant. But if it says something is not irrelevant, it may still be irrelevant, which is useful, right? Because if I am asking the query John calls, the query, my query is John calls given alarm is true, you would agree with me that nothing else matters other than A and J, because John calls given alarm is true, John is shielded from everybody by alarm. That's the whole definition of Bayes network. And in fact, you can just read that off from the conditional probability table. And, you know, if you look at the irrelevance based on this, you would still think B and E are somehow relevant. Whereas, if you do this, you would realize that neither B nor E nor M are relevant, which is good. I mean, it's nice. I mean, I hope you understand that in this case, you really, really wanted to cut this, this, and this. Because this is, you're asking for BJ given A, and this should be a single lookup into the conditional probability table. And you better not be writing a sophisticated algorithm which does more than what you should be doing. Yes?
So, when separation complete?
I don't know. I don't think that's also complete. But it's definitely stronger than, yes? John given B. Oh, that's interesting. Let me see that. If you moralize this graph, so you want M to be John given B. Yes, that's a good point. So B is the evidence. And so his point, I think this is a very good point. Let me just point this out. What he's saying, what Will is pointing out is that this query, so this theorem actually gives, in this particular case, that M is irrelevant, okay? But if you use the moralization, which is this one, you would have essentially said these two are married off, and this is your query variable, this is your evidence variable, and the query variable is not separated from M, given the evidence variable, because there is a path like this. Yeah. Okay, yes.
So to add on to that, in the moral graph, you keep the direction in the mixed graph.
Mm-hmm.
So the marriages are undirected or bidirected, but everything else is directed. When you ask the separation question, the second directed path, then that's a combination of theorem one and morality at the same time. And that will get
M. So that, so if you keep the direction, your point is if you keep the direction, then you will get both the theorem, both the results, both M and.
Keep direction, but the narrative is undirected.
And then if you ask for separation, if
so, M separated from J by B, sure, and
then
it's separated from J all the time.
Okay. So do we know this as a theorem, or this is an observation? Okay. No, but we can check this out. Okay. So the one point that you should make sure that, because I just misrepresented it, is it's not the case that this condition is dominated by this condition. They don't subsume each other. Okay. I'll try to find whether there is a version along the lines that Will is suggesting that would subsume both. Okay. Other question? Okay. Finally, we get to stochastic simulation. Let's see how far we can get with that. So in the case of stochastic simulation, all you're doing, as I said, is you just need a coin, okay? You essentially draw samples, and to get the samples, you toss a coin which has the right probability. And if it says heads, if it says true, then you take the variable to be true. If it says false, you take the variable to be false, okay? So the basic idea is you draw n sample from some distribution and you use that, the samples, to compute the, estimate the values of the probabilities. And there are a series of ideas. We'll talk about sampling from the empty network first. Let's do that. So here is a very simple network. cloudy, sprinkler, rain, and wet grass. Is this singly or multiply connected?
Multiply
connected. Okay. So it's actually a bad graph. So it's like this is the kind of ones which are, you know, exponentially hard. Okay. So now this graph, as it is given, basically corresponds to a joint distribution. Given a joint distribution, you should be able to draw samples from that joint distribution. Okay. What I'm going to tell you right now is how to draw samples from that joint distribution without actually directly enumerating the entire joint. Okay. So this is how we do it. We start from the first node, cloudy. Okay. And you start from here, and you know it basically says cloudy is true with 0.5 probability. So I take a coin which is 0.5 heads, 0.5 tails up front. Toss it. Whatever it says is the value of cloudy. Okay? Let me see what my coin said. My coin said cloudy is true. This particular case, my coin said cloudy is true. Okay? Now, having said that cloudy is true, now I'm going to sample sprinkler and rain. Now, the first thing I notice is since cloudy is already true, the right probability I care about is this here and this here. Because cloudy is already true, right? So to get my sprinkler value, I take a coin which comes heads with 0.1 probability, tails with 0.9 probability, and toss it. And let me see what it says. It said sprinkler is false, this particular case. So if I did this, remember it's more likely to come false than true, but it can come true sometimes. Even though it's less likely, it could have come true. So just assume in this case that I did toss in front of you and I got sprinkler pop. And similarly, here to get the rains value, I took another coin. This time the coin has 0.8 probability of heads, 0.2 probability of tails, tossed it. It's more likely to come heads than tails, but I could be unlucky. Let me see what happened. I got rain to be tails, true. And having gotten this, now I know that this is false, this is true, so the right number is that, right? So now I get the value of wet grass by taking a coin which goes heads 0.9 and tails 0.1 and toss it. It's very important to actually toss the coin. Now you take a biased coin, but you have to toss it, okay? And when you toss it, let's say whatever it says would be the value. So let's see what happened. It turned out that it came wet grass to be true because it's more likely to be true in here. So just now I have generated a sample from this network. What was that sample? Cloudy true, sprinkler false, rain true, wet grass true. I can do this again, I'll get another sample. I can do this again, I'll get another sample. That sample essentially is going to be consistent with the joint distribution. This is the notion of sampling from the empty network. Now, suppose I wanted to actually answer the query rain given sprinkler equal to true. That's what I want to answer. Not just generate samples. So suppose, in fact, one of the issues is this. If having generated these samples, suppose I did this sampling many times. Okay, one time I got C not S R W, one time I got C S not R W, etc. So I have 10,000 of these samples. Now all these 10,000 samples would be of 2 power 4 possible values, right? Only 16 values, 16 different entries in the 10,000 samples. So you can take the relative frequency of this guy in the 10,000 samples, for example, that would give the actual joint distribution for this. I could have gotten it also by just multiplying it, but I could get that number that way. So once I can generate samples, I can compute the actual probabilities corresponding to specific states. Now, suppose I wanted what's the probability that rain is true given sprinkler is true. Okay? What would I do? I could do the same thing that I did previously. Generate huge number of samples, only keep the samples where sprinkler is true. So this sample would be killed. Okay, so only keep those samples where Sprinklr is true. Let's say I generated 10,000 samples, of which 300 had Sprinklr true, and see how many of them have rain true. Suppose, let's say 100 of them had rain true, then 100 by 300 is probability of rain true given Sprinklr true. So I don't need to go through this entire variable elimination thing. All I need is a coin, and I can answer this question. Looks very nice, right? Okay. The tricky question, of course, is how fast does this converge? So for example, in this case, you're saying, suppose there are 27 samples have a Sprinklr equal to true, and 8 of them have rain also true, and 19 have rain false, then really the posterior distribution is 8-19. Normalize it. 8 and 19 normalize such that they add up to 1. So 8 by 8 plus 19 and 19 by 8 plus 19. Those are the numbers. Okay? Now, this is almost basically computing samples from the probabilities from the sample. Okay? The problem with this is the following. Suppose it turns out that Sprinklr being true is a very low probability event to begin with. So for example, I might be asking a question like this. What is the probability that death is true given that Ebola virus is true? Death true given Ebola virus true is very high. But the number of cases where Ebola virus is true is extremely small. So if you are generating true random samples, most of the samples you'll get, you'll keep throwing out the window saying, oh, this is not Ebola, this is not Ebola, this is not Ebola. Nothing is Ebola. And so you'll just get an estimate of zero, which is no good. Okay? Basically, you have to do large number of samples before you start having these unlikely events get represented in the samples. And the question is, can you make this process converge faster? And this is the last idea we'll talk about today. What we will do is we will fix the evidence variable to be whatever value we want them to be. And then say that if the coin says they, you know, basically, when the, we fix the evidence variables to be whatever values they want to be, whatever values we want them to be, but we may consider not all samples to be equally likely. So previously, there are, let's say, 27 samples, each give one weight, weight one, for the numerator and the denominator. Now you can start having samples which are 0.03 good. Okay? Let me explain that. Okay? So in this case, suppose I'm trying to compute, presumably, suppose I'm trying to compute the posterior distribution given Sprinklr is true and wet grass is true. Okay? Given Sprinklr is true and wet grass is true. So they must be true in whatever sample I generate. So I would start from the top. I would generate the value for cloudy. Okay? When cloudy is, now cloudy has given out, come out to be true because of my coin. Now, normally if cloudy is true, Sprinklr is not likely to be true. Because cloudy day means it's a rainy day. So there won't be Sprinklr. So in fact, that's why it says, if cloudy is true, Sprinklr being true is only 0.1 probability. So if you actually try to sample this guy's value by tossing the coin, it would have come not Sprinklr. And it would have been a rejected sample. Instead, we say, we want Sprinklr to be true. What do I need to give you so that Sprinklr would be true? And I basically say, well, when the cloudy is true, Sprinklr true is 0.1 probability. So I will assume that whatever happens to the rest of this sample, right now this sample is only 0.1 good. It's not 1 good, it's 0.1. It only gives 0.1 weight. Okay? So I wind up adding, multiplying. So original weight for the sample is 1. Now as soon as I clamped Sprinklr to be true and made sure that it will be true, I had to take a hit, which is 0.1. And similarly, I now sampled rain. Remember that rain is not an evidence variable, so I can sample it. Okay? I sampled rain and I found that it's true. Okay? And at this point, I have sampled rain and Sprinklr has been put in place. So these are both true, and both of them are true. The wet graph is true is 0.99. So for the evidence variable, I won't toss a coin. I'll assume it's what it is saying in the evidence variable. And so this has to be true, and for this to be true, you need 0.99 probability. So I multiply this by 0.99. At this point, I have generated a sample which has evidence true. In this sample, sprinkler is holding and wet grass is holding. Okay, and yet this sample is not going to give me, it's not as good as one sample in the previous kind of scenario. It's as good as a 0.099 sample. It's better than nothing, because previously in the rejection sampling, you'd have thrown away any sample which doesn't agree with the evidence. And if the evidence is very unlikely to begin with, then most samples would not agree with the evidence. It's like evidence is Ebola, most samples would not agree with Ebola. But now what we did was we just made sure that Ebola is true. If that meant reducing the weight of the sample, we would do that. Okay? If you do this, this is called likelihood weighting, and it's significantly faster in convergence than the previous idea, which is rejection sampling. Because rejection sampling would throw away most of the samples because they don't agree with the evidence. Whereas this guy, rather than throw it away, it says partial credit for the sample. Okay? And so it can converge to the actual value faster. Of course, there is a question of, can you prove that these things converge without any bias? That means, if you take infinite number of such samples, would the probability that you estimate this way be equal to the true probability? And if you're interested in that proof, look at the textbook. Yes? So this is basically, suppose for example you're looking for what's the probability that rain is true, rain is true given sprinkler and wet grass. So I need worlds where sprinkler and wet grass are true, and the fraction of the worlds where rain is true. In this case, this is a world, it's a 0.099 world where rain is true, where the evidence is true, and where rain also happens to be true. So that's how you use it. Yes?
Mm-hmm. 10,000 different cases. You'll only have 16 distinct things, 2 to the 4.
Yes.
So in this case, when you clamp down on things, you'll reduce it. You'll have only now 2 to the 2. You'll have maybe.
Yes. Basically, you're making those. So in some sense, you're clamping the world such that the evidence that you have observed will be holding in the world. But then the world would not be as good as 1.0. Yeah. Now, remember, would not be as good as 1.0. This is called likelihood weighting. It's a very small trick, it looks like, on the original idea, but it is significantly faster in convergence compared to the first one. And when you're doing approximate inference, the big issue is how many samples do you need before you converge. Okay? And all Monte Carlo methods suffer from this problem that if the evidence is very unlikely to begin with, if you do rejection sampling, you are likely to basically get zeros, as most samples won't agree with the evidence, and so you just throw them out. And so you don't have any evidence. Okay? We'll stop here. We'll come back next class and start talking about first order logic. Next class being after the exam. What? Midterm will only cover up to the third homework. That's it. It does not cover Bayes networks at all. Yeah.
You know how you said we're doing this clamping down thing to reduce the number of samples you need for convergence.
Mm-hmm.
Is it not possible that, so for example, if you're trying to get generic something, say P of
P of S given something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the probability that happens in the world is very low, which is why you need a lot of samples. Can't you just take the negation of that? So the probability of the complement of that happening will be very high.
No, but the point is, it may not be Boolean variable. For example, the disease may not be just Ebola and no disease.
Oh.
It could be Ebola, flu, common cold, this, that, everything. Yeah.
But if it's Boolean, we can do 1 minus.
Possibly. Possibly. I mean, that could make sense in that scenario, but I don't know that in general.
Yeah.
You know, it's an unlikely evidence, and you are counting. So here is actually, this is, what is the interesting thing? This also brings up a very interesting philosophical question. So, I should send you the correct thing, but so suppose I want to compute the probability that all magical ravens are blue colored. This is the probability. So if I tell you that raven is magical, then its color is blue. Or maybe grew. In fact, it's more interesting. It's grew, okay, which is some random color that I made up. Okay. Now, you'll never actually see a magical raven. Right? So you really don't know whether this probability is true, you know, high or not. But the question is, every time you say a raven that's not magical and it's not grew, does that add to your evidence somehow? I should get the nicer, interesting connection, which is, so you can't always say, because the evidence, negation of the evidence is holding, something can be done with it.
But, I mean, you can do it if you know it's Boolean. If you know that...
Well, I mean, the magical or not magical is Boolean.
Right, but you don't know that there are magical ravens, right? I mean...
No. I mean, so, that doesn't matter. I mean, you don't know beforehand. I mean, much of this stuff can be done as a learning as well as inference. So one of the interesting thing about this whole sampling based probability estimation is that you are generating samples given the model, which is the Bayes network, right? What if